This is an oral history interview on the 10th of July 2014 for the Westminster School Archives with Alex Bishop
and Stephen Spur, the outgoing headmaster.
Well, good morning, headmaster. Perhaps you'd like to start by just describing perhaps the school that you found when you arrived 9 years ago. What struck you about the school?
Well, one has the benefit, obviously, of coming in with fresh eyes, at the same time as knowing the school quite well from its very, very distinguished history, and indeed one's distinguished predecessors as headmaster. But I think a strategic answer to that would be that I felt, as with very many great schools, which had built up its traditions over time and accumulated various initiatives and been adapting as best it could to the times and the reforms, educational and otherwise, and society too. My strategic view was that this was a school now which did need to, how shall I put it, rediscover its purpose. And reshape itself, if you like, in the 21st century.
It's interesting there that you mention the historic reputation of the school as well as its more recent reputation for certain things. Did you arrive at the school then with some idea of what you wanted to change about the school, what, looking forwards, what you would do in your headmastership?
Well, as a classicist, I suppose I do look to the past before I look to the future. And as someone who's trying to teach his daughter how to drive, I always suggest it's worth looking in the rear view mirror before we pull out from the curb. So the history of the school for me was very, very important. But looking back over that history, it's not as though it was a uniformly upward trajectory. And one of the lessons of the past was that, yes, precisely, one needs, even with that very distinguished history, to look very carefully and make sure that the school in its present form is fit for purpose. And certainly the governors felt that it did need to reassess itself. And my view was that without losing any sense of that great history, without changing anything fundamentally, nevertheless there was quite a lot to transform in order to make it a great school looking forward as well as looking back. I suppose on a personal level, I have in my drawing room a couple of portraits of esteemed predecessors who only lasted one term as headmasters, and I thought to myself, well, at least one personal goal here is to last one term. the question of lasting for 57 years, which another esteemed predecessor had managed, I thought that was out of the question.
Yes.
So, first hurdle, last one term, and aim to consult and listen with people over that first year in order to reshape ourselves for the future.
Thanks. So, as far as I'm aware, your previous experience of being a headmaster was at Clifton in Bristol, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That's a big school formed of three schools, what we call the upper school, which was about the size of Westminster, the preparatory school and the pre-preparatory school.
Right, okay. So, were there many things then that would be similar from being a headmaster at Clifton to being a headmaster at Westminster? You speak of the school with quite a almost a sense of, you know, knowing that it was a different place to many other institutions. Does that mean then that it was a different experience for you?
Oh yes, I think so. I think any headmaster who comes to a new school and thinks, okay, I'm just going to bring my stuff from the past, is stepping out with in completely the wrong direction. You must try to understand what is the ethos of that school. as I said, and I'm sure we'll discuss it later on, I felt that ethos probably needed to be rediscovered at Westminster. But Clifton, yes, what are some of the practical things that one learned? Well, co-education was very important. Clifton was co-educational all the way through from age 3 up to 18. A school in a city, the grand city of the southwest. A school linked with a local university, a great university. I also found Clifton in quite a difficult financial state. And so one of the things that I realised that a head must do is ensure that he or she is right on top of the finances, which many heads today still are rather dismissive of, and they leave that to the bursarial side. One of the immediate changes I did when I came to Westminster was that bursar should be reporting to the headmaster rather than reporting directly to the governors. Because, you know, a headmaster, as if you like, a chief executive officer of any company, does need to have his or her eye on the finances as well. And I guess I'd go back a little further, Alex, back to Eton too then. Eton, a very, very large school, a very successful school. I was lucky as a housemaster and a head of a large department and someone in charge also of the curriculum change there. To understand how a very, very successful and large school works. And then before Eton, of course, being a university academic, to understand, if you like, something which I felt was essential about Westminster, in many ways different, Westminster different from other schools, that we had here a school where teachers and pupils were actually really involved in intellectual pursuits. And a school which, in some ways, has those links and sees itself in some ways as a sort of mini-university, which I think is something very, very precious. So I think perhaps all those jobs in the background before coming here helped me to think about Westminster.
So just picking up on the things that you said in a similar order to how you put them across there, you mentioned the co-educational nature of Clifton being very important. Do you think the Westminster model of having girls in the sixth form and remove only works well as the school is at the moment?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. Of course, when Westminster went co-educational in the sixth form, back whenever it was, and the historians will tell us it's early 70s, we were ahead of the game at that point. And then in more recent years, where other schools had come on board, other HMC boys' schools had come on board with co-education, then they went fully co-educational, like Clifton College. And we were then seen as something of sort of a dinosaur or a relic of the past by only just having girls in the sixth form. My own view is, having seen single-sex teaching at Eton, co-education right through at Clifton, that actually the Westminster model is the right one. It's certainly the right one for London. I would say it's probably the right one in general. And one, for example, thing that one notices at a fully co-educational school is that certain things, I know dear to your heart, the music, the choir is almost entirely made up of girls. The orchestra is almost entirely made up of girls. Whereas if you've had boys through to 16, then girls come and join in that really exciting co-educational sixth form, then you have those sorts of things which are much more balanced. But you do have to ask yourself, why should you be excluding from your school 50% of the population up until age 16? It's a question which I've asked myself very often, but I've come to the view that a post-16 co-education is the right one. And some endorsement of that has been given to me by three very good schools, which in my time at Westminster have come to ask my advice in a very nice way about doing precisely that, going co-educational only in the sixth form. It's Magdalen College in Oxford, University College School in London and King's College School in Wimbledon.
Mm.
And they've all started the Westminster model. And seeing Westminster, again, as the leader in that sense.
Absolutely. And I suppose that's very important as well for the girls to increase the number of places that are available at sixth form level. I know that it's very competitive currently to get into Westminster, and with the increasingly competitive nature of getting into university as well, it's for the girls that the two-stage process is quite difficult for them, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would, Alex. I would say that one of the things that I first felt needed to be changed in reassessing ourselves for the 21st century, if you like, was that if you were to trace the introduction of co-education at Westminster, it was sort of done almost by accident.
Right.
Then with, you know, one or two sorts of ideas at governing body level of why that might be a good thing. But one thing I noticed straight away, just by looking at the house photographs, was you would have the boys, and then you'd have a few girls just perched on either wing of that photograph. And I could see that we needed really to turn that right round and say, this is a co-educational sixth form.
Yes.
This is not a boys' school with some girls added in.
Mm.
And so one of the things we did very early on in that first year was to decide what the size and composition of the school should be.
Mm.
The school has been gradually, incrementally growing over the years, but no one actually stopped to think, well, what is a maximum number or what is an optimum number?
Yes.
So we hit on what we felt was an optimum number. And within that, I said that in the co-educational sixth form, we should be going for 2/3 boys and 1/3 girls.
Mm.
And I said also we should be going for a minimum of 1/4 boarders to make this an authentic boarding school, still with a boarding ethos. Why 1/3 girls, 2/3 boys? Well, it was quite a lot less than 1/3 girls. So it was a question of increasing the number of girls without decreasing the number of boys.
Mm.
Because there would have been an outcry about that. And therefore we had to increase the overall size of the school, however, to something manageable. And so the school increased to 714. And within that we can have 1/3 girls and 2/3 boys. That, I think, you can then call something just about co-education.
Mm.
But if you drop below that proportion, that's going to be difficult. And then, a symbolic act, I suppose, was my first year, right from the start, I said, we want a head girl.
Yes, absolutely.
On day one.
Yes.
That sent shockwaves through the system.
Mm.
But there was a part of those, if you like, that reshaping the traditions of co-education which crept in and making actually something of a virtue of it.
Yes. So would you say then that that ethos of co-education is ingrained in the school enough, considering that there are only 1/3 girls and 2/3 boys? The school looks very closely, obviously, at making sure that the girls don't feel in the minority at all.
Mm.
But do you think, you know, we go far enough to make sure the girls are equally treated?
Well, I would like to think that over time I have worked quite closely at that. The common room too has increased in numbers of female members over the 9 years.
Yes. Yeah.
That has been something of a conscious point as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we also live in a society which is changing as well.
Yeah.
So I don't think we should ever slip below 1/3, 2/3.
Mm.
The 1/3, 2/3 now allows the girls and some of the boys who arrive at sixth form not to feel as though they are a tiny minority, which are never really going to get on with things. It is actually quite a sizable input, 70 pupils coming in to the school. And that, I think, then helps the boys who have been here through up to the upper shell to reassess and see the sixth form as a new beginning as well. And that is something that I always say. It's a new beginning for those coming into the school. It's also a new beginning for those who have been in the school for 3 years.
Mm.
And that co-educational sixth form, as it stands at the moment, I think is a wonderful thing, where boys and girls learn to their mutual benefit.
Mm. So in managing the finances of the school, obviously there are two threads which are quite important to pick up on. One is, of course, expanding the facilities of the school for the benefit of the pupils. But the other, which I know you've been very keen to increase, is the money which is spent on social mobility and the Bursary Foundation. So is that sometimes a difficult thing to balance?
Well, yes, I think it can be, Alex. with the a school runs obviously. I mean, it, a school like this is quite a sizable business. I mean, we're talking something in large handfuls of a £30 million turnover, annual turnover, and the obvious incomings are through fees, and roughly two-thirds of the outgoings are on staff salaries. One of the things that I've been quite proud of is that you know, we continue to pay our excellent teachers well at this school. Some of my American colleagues actually had to go out and do fundraising in order to pay the staff. Right. I don't think I would have lasted very long whether, you know, if I'd had to do that. But anything, any major expansion of facilities, which obviously we've done over the past 9 years, or any expansion of financial assistance to make a Westminster education a possibility for bright young people with aspirations from elsewhere and modest backgrounds, does require quite a lot of extra input, and that does have to come from fundraising. So I did feel that on coming here that you know, we needed to do more about finding our pupils of ability from modest backgrounds and then raising the money to make it possible for them. And I think probably one of my best early moments as a headmaster was after a year we'd been here and we had a fundraising evening for to start to build up our bursary money. And we raised £1 million on that evening. That was an example of having decided on a strategy which I felt was part of Westminster rediscovering its ethos. Yeah. You go back to that 1560 charter of Elizabeth I, she talked about 40 poor scholars. But Westminster has never been short of rich people and people of substantial means sending their children to the school. But it has always, from its 1560 start, to try to look out for what Elizabeth I calls poor scholars. And I think we'd lost our way somewhere along the line in that.
Yes.
And that was one area I felt we wanted to rediscover. So yes, I have put a lot of money into fundraising. Schools could do this in two ways, Alex. One, they fundraise on a permanent basis to try to build a very large endowment, which then you kind of either you invest and you take the interest that you make off that endowment and put that to your financial assistance. Westminster has some monies of that sort, but they are not particularly, you know, when the financial crash came along, you're not actually getting your money to yield much in investment. So I took a decision that we weren't going to try to just carry on building up this huge endowment. We were actually going to raise the money year on year and plough that straight into financial assistance. And that no pupil who was able to cross the academic threshold to get into Westminster would be denied a place only because his or her family didn't have the means. So it's on an annual basis, and that's one reason, for example, we set up what's called an annual fund, a fund for Westminster, which brings in something like £400,000 a year, which goes to bursaries.
So looking then to the wider outreach of the school, how important would you say is the setting up of the Westminster Harris Academy just across the road, which will start next year, of course?
Yes, I think it's a... I mean, it's a very, very good point. I thought again that Westminster needed to reassess its and rediscover its ethos in looking outwards. I think probably I did find a school that was very concerned with itself.
Right.
And I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
In as much as charity begins at home, as the old phrase goes. But then it goes on to say, but it doesn't end there. Sometimes headmasters make the mistake, very virtuous headmasters, of thinking, what is the school doing for the local community? And forgetting actually what it's doing for itself. the school was all about itself. In some ways, I thought it was probably rather too individualistic and rather too sort of inward-looking. But we did need to look out. One of the first things we did was, as I said, start raising money on an annual basis, and every 5 years, one of these £1 million evenings before bursaries. Mm. A second was the Westminster Summer School.
Yes, of course.
Which we started 6 years ago, and that is linking in with a whole network of central London state schools, many of which, of course, conclude their teaching at age 16. And it was a question of finding aspirational young people from those schools who were interested in going not only onto the sixth form, but then on to university, to inspire them with the idea, well, why don't they carry on with their education rather than going out and getting a job straight away.
Yeah.
So that was the Westminster Summer School. And both the bursary opportunities we were offering and the Westminster Summer School alerted me to the fact that there are hundreds of young people out there in London from disadvantaged backgrounds who don't feel that they're getting much of an avenue to progress from GCSE onwards and through to university. And that, if you like, and many more than I could help through a bursary scheme or just inspired through the Westminster Summer School. And so this was part of the genesis of this sixth form free school we put on. And so I think that, again, is to be seen, that is a development, to be seen in, if you like, rediscovering the ethos going back to 1560 and then taking it through to something of a logical conclusion.
Yes, that's interesting. So in talking about the school rediscovering its ethos and the school's wider outreach in certainly the local area and in education in general, do you think that the media portrays the school in a fair light often, or are we feel maligned by the media sometimes?
Well, I remember when I was at Clifton, I was trying to re-put Clifton on the map. And so I was very keen to be getting it in the local press all the time.
Right.
And most schools do that.
Mm.
Here at Westminster, it became very clear to me that one of my main jobs was actually to keep Westminster out of the press.
Yeah.
Because one mustn't forget that one's local papers are national newspapers here.
Mm.
Mm. And if the recent history of the school teaches anything, it is that a headmaster who spends a lot of time commenting on educational matters and social matters and civic matters in the press, it is probably going, well, in the end, it's not going to be very helpful either to him or to the school.
Mm.
And so I felt there was quite a big job to be done at the school, as I began to indicate, and better, therefore, to be concentrating on that rather than telling everyone what we're trying to do or commenting on more wider themes in the press. So I suppose I will take two or three calls from the press each day.
Right, yes.
On often things nothing to do with Westminster. And we'll actually be saying, Westminster's got nothing to say about that matter.
Right, really. Yes.
But what I do always do is comment on when I think we can say something which is actually going to move the education debate along.
Mm.
And then sometimes, of course, things hijack me a little bit, like that recent heckling out here in College Garden, and when something happens, and then I have to do my best, as it were, slightly firefighting.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose that's always the hard thing about being the headmaster, is you can't plan for those sorts of events. You just have to respond.
So one needs to respond. Then, of course, one needs to obviously have a very good relationship with all the journalists.
Mm.
And, they therefore know that they would come to me for, if you like, quote-unquote serious matters to do with educational reform.
Yes.
If some pupils have done silly things, or what the Daily Mail, for example, thinks noteworthy things, that at least they will give me a chance to respond before they go to print.
Yes, yes. I suppose anecdotally there was one moment when we were all having a good chuckle on the tube home in the Evening Standard. Anthony Seldon, I think, had said something about private schools and university admissions, and and we thought that Westminster School's position on it was a much fairer one. I believe you commented that we hadn't noticed any drop in our university.
Yes, exactly. I mean, one doesn't want to cross Sir Anthony Seldon too often, but in some ways, one's, as a headmaster, one's very grateful for Anthony Seldon, who's willing to comment on absolutely everything to do with education. And if he didn't exist, one feels that one would need to invent him to be able to do that for one. But every so often, I have found myself having just to give a slightly counterweight to some of his, I think, comments, which have possibly taken the media in the wrong direction.
Mm.
And yes, that was an example. There was something in the Times, and there was something in the Evening Standard.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as a child of the 90s and then of the noughties, I've certainly felt that social media has exploded in my time, not only at Westminster but at my prep school as well. And so, of course, that has happened in line with your time as headmaster. Mm. Do you think that's played a big role in shaping how the school runs, certainly, and how you've had to interact with the students?
Well. Unlike, social media, use of the internet in general, it has a whole range of aspects to it.
Mm.
Some of my esteemed colleagues in other schools sort of try to ban the internet and social media, and I mean, I think that is always a total mistake. My line has always been, and you will remember it, I trust, from fifth form PSHE and onwards and things I've said to you, is that one needs to educate young people on how responsibly to use the internet. Social media, of course, I think it's a hugely positive thing in many ways. I myself don't use it very often, although, you know, I have a number of sites of my own and other things on social media. But one thing I do caution you all about is that your relationships should not just be virtual. And when boys and girls go wrong in the school with social media, it is that they will say things on social media to each other which they would never, ever, in a million years, say face-to-face. And there is a bit of a worry that, you know, the society becomes a virtual one and we're all slightly locked away in our own areas. I remember one of the things I first found when I first came to Westminster was many, many of the pupils, and at that time I'm talking about another technological thing, were wandering around. Do we call them Walkmen in those days?
Right, yes.
Things move on.
Yes.
The Walkmen. And they had their things in their ears. And they weren't talking to each other. And I said, this is a community.
Mm.
As soon as you step into Dean's Yard, take that stuff out of your ears. We do need to talk to each other.
Yes.
And there is that slight danger with social media that becomes, as it were, the substitute for real life, building a community. Which is what I call the community is the local face of society. And if we're aiming to try to get a more cohesive society, we do need to be communicating properly. And I think social media is very, very helpful, but don't fall into the trap of living a virtual life.
Yes, I suppose that's interesting. And you said there that people often tend to say things on social media that they wouldn't say to other people in general. So educating people then about social media is probably part of the school's wider moral education.
Very much.
The dean once asked me whether the school was doing a good job in morally educating the students. How would you say that the school manages to do that?
A very good point. Let me just finish quickly on social media.
Do.
One of the things, of course, one needs to keep one's common room up to date.
Right, yes.
With that. One also needs to keep parents up to date.
Mm.
And one of the things I'm very proud of is this development of what we call the parenting forum.
Yes.
Where parents are invited in, and they themselves work with me and other members of the common room to come up with issues which are a concern to them so we can discuss them and get it back. Mm-hmm. You normally an external consultant in to talk about it, and social media, internet and things, is that's one thing that they are often concerned about. But coming back to the moral, I think the moral purpose is absolutely central to the school, and that was another area I felt we needed to rediscover our ethos.
Yeah.
and reshape it for the future. I did find a school which I felt was, pupils were telling me, oh, we're all individuals here. And I agree that Westminster stands for identifying and nurturing the individual talents of young people and bringing them out and giving them every opportunity to take them to the highest level. But I pointed out very early on, and I think almost in my first assembly, that there's a difference between the word individual and the word individualistic. That people who are pretty much only interested in themselves and they are extremely competitive without being cooperative, that I think is self-destructive and destructive of the community. I found Westminster community heading in that direction. I also found a school that had been heading away from the Abbey for a while.
Yeah.
And I felt the Abbey, if you like, and I'm going to use a rather crude term, you know it's a shorthand, was a very undervalued and underused resource for the school. And I am someone who fundamentally will go back to the idea, again, of Westminster's founding principle, of my job as a headmaster is to help the formation of the character and the moral purpose of it, his pupils. And so if you go back to those lines in the 1560 charter, that pupils are the tender shoots in the wood of our state, and they are to be liberally educated in good books to the honour of that state, two things. My job is to take those tender shoots, you yourselves, and to give you a sense of purpose. And part of that purpose is that the privileged education you are receiving is a public good. And therefore you must have the character, the moral purpose, and the social responsibility to use your education, not only for your private fulfilment, but for public fulfilment as well. That I felt was lacking. We were all about private fulfilment, not much more about a community with a common purpose for that greater purpose for yourselves and for society. And I think that's what I'd like to see. Perhaps I've nudged us towards that route, and I hope that will be developed for the future.
Yes, and of course it says in the school prayer, does it not, we should become profitable members of our church and nation.
Absolutely right. Yes. And something which very I believe important. Very, very strongly about.
Yes. So how then would you say that the relationship of the school with the Abbey has developed in your 9 years?
Well, I would like to think that we have both Abbey and school have reassessed what I call the indissoluble link between the two. After all, we are part of that one collegiate foundation. I was helped, of course, in my time here with the build-up and then, of course, the wonderful celebrations in 2010. Was that your first year?
Yes.
Were you in the lower shell? I can't remember.
I was in the fifth form. Yes, I arrived September 2009, so I was in the fifth form.
Of course, I had been building up to that for 3 years.
Yes.
I saw that as, right, 2010, 450th anniversary, this is going to give me an opportunity, as it were, sort of more than just a peg to hang on, the reshaping of the school's direction and purpose. But very, very importantly, that the Abbey itself was going to be obviously part of that. And so, as soon as the new dean was appointed, because my first year was without a dean and without a chairman of governors. Had I not been a headmaster before, I would have been totally at sea. So as soon as he was appointed, I said, you know, we want to really make this 2010 celebration very, very important. And working up to it was one thing where we really brought the school and the Abbey together. And that, if you like, gave us a vehicle for looking at all sorts of ways that we might have the chaplain more centre stage, the whole question of morality and spirituality more centre stage, and the bringing just the institutional side of both the Abbey and the school together. And sometimes, of course, this thing depends on personalities. I have an enormous respect for the Dean of Westminster and get on with him very well personally. And I think that means that personal chemistry, I think, is very important too. Mm. But it's very much, for me, part of that moral and social purpose of the school and what I've been trying to do for you, the pupils. And therefore, absolutely essential to that is to bring the Abbey and the school together.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm sure we'll talk about the sort of character of Westminster students that you might find in a moment, but just linking in then the idea of bringing the school's ethos to the fore and this element of spirituality from the Abbey, do you think that the students responded well to the changes that were made, or was there resistance?
Well, the beauty of going back and rediscovering the traditions,
yeah,
and therefore coating that with the ethos with intelligent people is that they immediately see themselves within that greater picture,
yes.
And they immediately respond to the call, if you like, in the present community, to take forward the best of what we've done and known in the past. They had been already responding to my nudging them to be less individualistic and more a question of individuals working together for some greater good. And one of the things that we brought in with 2010 was the civic engagement.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a new term. I wanted to get the idea of engagement. We were all going to engage. So I wanted to get something which was going to be beyond, I don't know, moral or just community. Move away something from community service, because community service, when I first came, was a station that people did if they couldn't find anything else to do.
Oh, right.
And the idea that community service was something, if you didn't want to play football, you want to play netball, and you were actually not very sporty, you did community service. That didn't seem to be quite right. My vision was that every single pupil in the school should have some, at some point in his or her time here, some significant input to something to help the community, the wider community, the local community. Mm. So we developed this term civic engagement, and we really started that off in 2010 with the parable of the two talents.
Yes, I remember.
The parable of the talents. And to my great joy, Westminster pupils really stepped up to that. And we've just done an exit poll of your year, right, which was really the first year to have got going with that, back when you started in the fifth form. 96% of the boys have been involved in something significant. A small percentage of the girls. And that's interesting. I don't think that's because girls are less generous and interested in community service. It's just that, of course, they're here for less time.
Yes.
And perhaps I haven't worked hard enough on imbuing them with that sense that they are should be sort of loyal to something bigger than themselves. I mean, they come to Westminster for reasons. You know, they want really good teaching, they want this, they want that, and it's all about getting their feet under the table as quickly as possible and doing as much as possible and getting on. But I'm not quite sure yet whether I've fully imbued them with that greater sense. So I think that is something I hope which will continue as part of that sort of co-educational side. So I think Westminster pupils have been absolutely great in that sense of the sort of greater sense of social responsibility, and along with that then one can talk about the moral compass, one can talk about spirituality. Let's not forget, I mean, back in 2004, when was it? I mean, your knowledge about these things is probably better than mine. Was it in 2004 with that great Enron scandal? Do you remember?
Oh, yes, I do recall.
And
yes.
It was a kind of apex of what I saw was corporate lack of social responsibility.
Mm.
People at the top of these institutions just totally out for their own profit. And one of the first addresses I gave in Abbey when I was here was, we are a leading school. The corollary of that is that we will be leaders. I need to be producing leaders for society. What does leadership mean for me? It means service. And so I tried to lay that out right from the start.
Yeah.
And Westminster pupils have taken that on, I think. And that's one of the things I've been most pleased about.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned at the beginning of that answer that tradition is obviously very important to the life of the school. Did you feel, arriving 9 years ago and then in your first few years as headmaster, that these traditions were something which would be sustained in the future of the school? Obviously, time is becoming increasingly at a premium in our lives. Some people have mooted the idea that Latin prayers could be a more efficiently run assembly, and you know, perhaps the prayers aren't necessary anymore. What do you think about the school's traditions?
Well, it's a debate from time to time, and I did actually hold a little poll, not a terribly scientific one, at some point. You know, after I'd been here for a couple of years, do we want to do away with the Latin prayers? That is, having come in as a new headmaster and made a point of Latin prayers, I remember hearing a Latin prayers of my distinguished predecessor, who, as it were, could recite the Latin prayer in his sleep, having been here as man and boy. And his view of it seemed to be, how do I get through it as quickly as possible? Which is one thing that some people still think, you know, let's get this through as quickly as possible. And there's some sort, I don't know whether there's any kind of bets going on, how quickly we can read the stuff. No. But it seems to me that if you're going to have a tradition, then you have to take it serious, treat it seriously.
Yeah.
If you don't think it's worth as a tradition, well, say so. But don't, as it were, misuse it or use it lightly. I mean, it's either something we're going to believe in or it's not. What does the word tradition mean? I mean, it's a rhetorical question, don't worry. And tradition means something which is handed on. Well, if it's not worth handing on, well, you know, we can get rid of it. We can make up a new tradition. But if it is something which you think has gone right back to the time of Elizabeth I, and at times of the execution of Charles I, for example, where the diktat went out, there should be no prayers said in the country at that time, at the execution for Charles I. One of my distinguished predecessors said that no school, we will say the Latin prayer from this day. Well, with that sort of tradition, you think to yourself, well, let's keep this going. And enjoy it. I mean, as a society as a whole, I mean, lots of modern European societies and modern republics will say, one of the great things about Britain is its traditions. So keep them going. If they become, in my view, sometimes if they're a bit quaint or something like the Grease or something like that, well, we've also got to have a bit of fun as well.
Yes.
I mean, so traditions can be fun and enjoyable too. But don't, if you're going to have them, make a point of them. Don't sort of make excuses for them. And then, that informal poll was, yes, please, can we keep Latin prayers?
Well, there you are. That's cool. That's very interesting. So I suppose the traditions of Westminster, the history of the school, obviously, and it's the same with other great, the nine public schools and the Public Schools Act, obviously very important institutions, that almost sets them apart from other type institutions, other schools, and creates a divide between other institutions. Do you think Westminster has become closer to its competitors, as it were, looking to St Paul's on the river, of course, looking to Winchester, other schools? Have we moved in your time as headmaster, would you say?
Well, I'm probably not going to be as good as you as knowing what the traditions of St Paul's or Winchester are.
Right, yes.
I do know what the traditions of Eton are, and it's certainly, in my view, therefore, part of my view is informed by that, that one does need to keep to one's traditions. And certainly one of the things that the governors were concerned about, they were concerned that Westminster had, the way they put it to me, it had lost some of its style. And I think what they meant was to do with the ethos, perhaps, and the traditions, and not wanting to apologise for them. And I don't think Winchester or Eton or St Paul's apologise for their traditions. I mean, St Paul's is a young, well, it's not a young school, but I mean, it's not, it's the current site, it's young. So don't apologise for them. But do question them from time to time. I mean, here we are sitting in the archives. One of the things that I felt as soon as I got here was, what is a school with this huge tradition that it's got here doing without any serious form of archives?
Yeah.
And I had it in my mind that as soon as I possibly could, I would set up decent archives. And here, you see, here we are with Elizabeth sitting next to us, she's done a wonderful job. And actually, Westminster can no longer conceive of itself without its archives. And that's one of the secrets of headmastership. When an initiative that you've had becomes something which people think is so completely the fabric of the school, then you know you must have done something right.
Yeah.
And this is something I'm particularly proud of.
Yeah. So, picking up on that idea that the school had lost some of its style under your distinguished predecessors, do you think the decision to bring in the girls' school uniform, of course, has made a large difference to the how the school appears? Or do you think it was a difficult decision? There was a resistance on the court when it came in.
It's a very interesting point, Matt. I tend to call it school dress rather than uniform.
Yeah.
Uniform is an important point because it gives a uniformity to a community. And therefore, again, one is encouraged therefore to express one's individuality in different ways. I mean, through one's academic and intellectual pursuits and other ideas like that, rather than being able to afford or think about wearing wonderful new expensive clothes each day of the week. Also uniformity, because the boys had a uniform. And I tend to use school dress rather than uniform, because uniforms are often associated with badges and things like that. And the boys had something which gave the sense of, we are all individuals, but we're all working together within this community. And my view was that the girls wearing their own clothes was an example of Westminster actually just seeing girls as add-ons, rather than part of the school. I nudged over a period of time us to this position where we reached, and there were one or two false starts where suggesting that people would all be wearing black or dark things to begin with, and the girls, and then finally we came to this new school dress. People were saying to me it was going to be a marketing disaster because girls at St Paul's and other girls, single sex girls' schools in the sixth form, they can wear their own clothes, so no one is going to come to Westminster now because they're having to wear school dress. And I said, well, if that was the reason, the only reason, that's the thing that's going to turn them off, then they're not the right girls for school.
That's true. And of course, we've seen that hasn't happened.
It hasn't
now, a couple of years into having school.
I'm patting myself metaphorically, just very modestly on the back over that. But
excellent.
I think the uniform, to the big point, was that it brings the girls in as, it's a symbolic statement that they are actually fully part of the community. That's how I see it, as a positive statement.
Yeah. So I want to explore slightly more how your experience of the pupils has been, the students at Westminster. You've mentioned, of course, that they are individual in many ways, they're trying to express themselves, but are there traits, perhaps, that exist amongst all Westminsters, do you think, that you've seen?
Well, I think we've moved away from this individualistic point. I've been able to appeal to their better natures there. Towards the end of my first year, one of the canons of the Abbey said, your pupils still collide with us as they're rushing around madly in the cloisters as they did before, but at least they say sorry now. And that's right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite a nice measure of success. Mm. So I think they have become much more sense of, I would like to think, social responsibility, and that their privileged education here is something they shouldn't just take for granted, and it is for the public good. And actually, so I really do think they have responded to that, which I'm really, really pleased about. They are wonderful young people. I found again when I started working with them was that they were quite brittle because of their individualistic approach and their very competitive approach. They were always looking and competing with each other and keeping things to themselves and very private from that point of view. There's no sense in sort of... They had restrained their generosity of spirit. And so to see, you know, the current body of the school, I feel very, very pleased with that. I mean, I felt the first monitors, for example, had very little idea of what it was to be a monitor and what they were trying to do. So I have tried to harness their wonderful intelligence, creativity, which they've all had, their wonderful ambition, their wonderful way they try to seize their opportunities, to harness that with a sense of, you know, a Westminster community is something bigger than just the sum of the individuals. And we are trying actually to get out there at the end of the day to improve society, not just to mirror it. So I'm hoping that I've given a greater sense of collective responsibility as we step out from Westminster, go our different ways into the university and the world beyond, while at the same time doing nothing to restrict or constrain that sense of personal creativity and individuality.
Yeah, absolutely. Just picking up on that point about monitors not quite knowing what their role was. Do you think that they, you know, you've shaped the monitors to be a much more efficient body in terms of how they play a role in the school?
Yes, I'd like to think that. I'd like to think that the monitors are well chosen to be representative of right across the school, of, you know, many of the different aspects of the school. That they are chosen for their character as well as their achievements. That they are chosen by a wider group of people who know them well. And that then my job is to try to imbue them, if you like, with that social and moral sense, and that they themselves have great respect from within the school, from their peers, from the common room, from me, and they are there to help the headmaster and the senior teachers to make this community work. That was why shortly after coming I wrote that thing which I send each year, that letter to the monitors, which is tries to say something about what I want them to do. But to begin with, when I came, they were rather at a loss of what it was to be monitored. Leadership as service is something I've tried to instill rather than leadership as power.
So then how have the monitors affected your role as headmaster? Obviously they represent the student body, but they do more than that in terms of being around the school for your, you know, wider gains.
Yes, absolutely right. It's absolutely right, Alex. I mean, headmasters like to feel that they know everything that's going on. Very many of my colleagues delude themselves that they know what's going on. The monitors are terribly important to a headmaster. One of the things, therefore, is that, you know, I like the head boy and or the head girl to come see me on a regular basis in the morning and to be asking, you know, how things going. You know, getting their input is terribly important to me. And that's why then we instituted this idea of the fortnightly lunch and other things like to discuss things. I couldn't underestimate that. I've also tried to give a little bit more a status and a little bit more headmasterly thought for both the heads of houses and also for the peer supporters. and in general to try to promote the question of leadership and the opportunities for leadership among the senior student bodies are very, very important. I've also tried to give them more voice.
Yeah.
Things like Thought for the Day and Latin prayers, which didn't exist before, or a chance to come and sit and say something in the pulpit, or others.
Yes.
Again, I think, or the student council. I think there's more to be done, but terribly important. If you are trying, at the end of the day, as a headmaster, to educate your pupils to be a force for good in the outer world, you've got to give them the opportunity within the community, which is that face of the kind of the friendly face of society that they're going to be facing outside, to give them the opportunities to develop and show those skills.
So looking away from the students then and towards the common room, how has the common room changed in your time? You mentioned earlier that there are now more female members of staff, of course.
Well, again, if I may say, they call the common room. I felt that there wasn't much of a common purpose. So they themselves were really hungry, not that they themselves would put it quite like that, hungry for some direction and the rediscovery or reshaping of what their purpose was. And obviously one of the things that, you know, we have done with the common room is written development plan for the school, which has a vision and how it all breaks down. There was no development plan for the school when I came, and so working with the common room, one of the areas for development, I think, it's implicit in everything I've said, was the pastoral care and welfare of pupils, and indeed of staff. So we set up something called the Pastoral Planning Committee, so we could start thinking about these issues. And see it as a very, very important committee, if you like, to balance what we call the challenge committee, which is the academic planning committee on the other side, and get staff involvement in that, to get more staff involved in the development planning of the school. So bring them together to feel that ownership and rediscovery of the purpose of the school, at the same time as a senior, as a headmaster with a senior management committee that, again, was set up by me because there wasn't one before. My aim has also to be protect them from all the legislation, all the other things, all the management, all the finance, all the other things, so that they can actually get down with their sacred task of the pupil-teacher relationship, and to make this school hanging on to that intellectual tradition for which it's famous.
I should just ask, is this a good moment to stop?
I think it's very good. I think I've run out of energy.